Can you believe this limp mother? Man, he was burned. He was deep.
And did you speak with Niall?
Oh, yeah.
When and where?
Next time he come round T4. In that next week there. I like to wail on Niall. That's all just a psych, man. That motherfucker just playing us, man. And Niall, he kind of, you know, shrug and all. That how he be. He play you. I say I ain't down for that. No motherfucker play me, daddy or no. Got to stall out on that shit, man. I go head up any motherfucker, man, do me like that. I'd cap that motherfucker soon as look at him. I, you know, be gone like that.
And what, if anything, did Niall say?
Well, you know, he kind of like looking. Like he just ain't gonna believe nobody be raving on his daddy like that. And I'm like, fuck you, motherfucker. Fuck you up too, you want. I'm tripping and all.
At intervals, I've had some instinct to curb Hardcore's language. This is still a courtroom, to which the public is invited. But he is too natural, too forceful a storyteller in his own mode to bear much interruption. Even Hobie, who until this moment has had the star turn here, seems to have no urge to slow him down. Core, quite evidently, is enjoying himself. Over the months I've been sitting in Criminal, I've been struck by how often a simple, childish desire for attention accounts for the presence of many of these young people. Most of these kids grow up feeling utterly disregarded by fathers who departed, by mothers who are overwhelmed, by teachers with unmanageable classrooms, by a world in which they learn, from the TV set and the rap of the street, they do not count for much. Crime gathers for them, if only momentarily, an impressive audience. The judge who sentences, the lawyer who visits, the cops who hunt them. Even the victim who, for an endless terrified moment on the street, could not discount them. And following this exchange in which you informed Niall you were angry with his father, did you have any other conversation with Niall about Senator Edgar?
Nah, says Cor,
and freezes Tommy.
Not first. Then, you know, one day, might even be a month gone by, we all just kicking around T4 and he come up on me and he, like, first thing he asks me, yo, like, you really cool with that shit how you fade my daddy? So I be thinking, oh, you done it now, nigga. This P.O., he gonna get in your face how you ripping on his daddy. I's just talking shit, I say. And soon as I done said it, I can see, you know, like he busted.
Disappointed? Asks Tommy.
Right, says Hardcore. Right. So maybe 2 weeks later, man. I like, so how is it, dude? You really be wanting me to smoke you, daddy? And he say like that, yeah, I do.
Who's he? Tommy asks. Who were you talking to?
Niall.
The defendant.
Yeah, right.
Niall, when I look, has his chin at Hobie's shoulder. He is speaking to him with greater animation than he's shown at any point until now. Hobie is nodding emphatically as his expensive pen races across the yellow pad. And where were you when you had this talk? Who was around?
Just me and him. You know how it is. When he come down round T4, I was sort of, you know, getting him back to his mobile so he don't get jacked or nothing.
So you were escorting him down the street near T4 to his car?
Exactly, says Cor. He like, I'll give you $25,000, you fade him. And I go like, yo, you bent, man. Uh-huh, he say. Hell I am, anyhow. I mean what I say, you do it. I like, man, motherfucker. I see you motherfucking money, we gonna know you mean that you behind it. Whoa, dude, not down with that. He were burning, ready to tear it up. I ain't never seen him like that, man. He got up in my face. I know you here slanging dope and shit hardcore. You think I don't know? put you nigger ass back in the yard anytime I say. You under paper as it is, Cor. I'll pull you down whenever I like. Man, don't be tripping with me now. This here your idea from the jump. No way, motherfucker. This nigger ain't but going on. We tripping on that some. Who say do it? But I seen he stomped down on this, and I ain't taking no ride.
You agreed to do it rather than have him revoke your release.
Say I gonna think on it some. And you know then, every time I see the dude, he on me. You gonna do this, nigga, or ain't you? Thought you was some badass top-rank gang-banging motherfucker, but you just some bitch-ass sissy like all them elderly niggas down the corner by Best Way Liquor with they 40 zones of coke. He on me all the time.
Tommy stands a moment and frowns at his witness, clearly afraid that Hardcore, caught up in his performance, has gone straight over the top. Did you finally agree to kill Senator Edgar?
Ain't never finally agreed. Till one day he come up, he got that newspaper bag.
Cor points, and from the prosecution table, Tommy retrieves People's One, the money and the blue newspaper bag in which it was wrapped.
He give me that.
Where were you?
T4, on Gray Street. He by his ride, ain't even got himself out. He just come up by there and tell Bug go fetch Cor. And I come on down, there he be, and he hand me that there through the window. Say I give you the rest when you done it.
When was this?
August. Hot.
And what did you say?
I say, motherfucker, you fixing for me to do this?
He be like,
uh-huh, I am. So I figure, well, okay, then gonna have to get with it, otherwise he gonna pull my paper sure enough.
Tommy finishes laying an evidentiary foundation for the money. Hardcore says he took the bag to the home of Doreen McTanny, the mother of his son, Dormaine, and left it there until after the killing. He identifies his initials next to Montague's on the evidence bag. With the money in the plastic bag now fully tied to the defendant and the crime, Molto moves for admission of the exhibits. Any objection? I ask Hobie. He purses his lips.
Can I reserve for cross?
Hobie knows every trick. Having no basis to keep the money out of evidence, he wants to delay its admission in the hope that in the welter of last-minute details, the prosecutors will forget to reoffer the proof. Across his shoulder, Tommy tosses an irked look. By now he expects Hobie to be difficult. I admit the money, subject to cross, and Tommy picks up the thread with Cor, whom he asks about preparations for the killing.
Got with Gorgo and them. Tell Gorgo get him a good clean spout.
A clean spout would be a weapon that would not trace.
We got us to put in some work. Then I went rapping to Dooley Bug.
Is that Lavinia Campbell?
Uh-huh.
What did you tell her? Probably to keep Cor from getting rolling again, Hobie objects for lack of foundation, meaning that Cor has not said precisely when, where, and with whom the conversation took place. Tommy starts to explain, but Cor has been around enough courtrooms to understand and interrupts.
This here's day before we done it. Up the IV tower, just me and her.
He looks toward Hobie and sneers. Think what you think, motherfucker, but I ain't dumb. I doubt, however, anyone here has made the mistake of questioning Cor's smarts. And what did you tell her?
Put it down to her, whole scene, you know.
What did you tell her specifically about Niall?
Niall and me, we fixin' to gauge his daddy.
What did she say?
Oh, you know. Why all gotta be doing like that? That kind of shit.
And you said,
yo, freeze up, ho. You just be working here.
The unvarnished accuracy and vehemence with which Cor recalls his response provokes momentary laughter in the courtroom. Cor smiles as if he had fully calculated his audience's reaction in advance. Did Bug know Niall?
Hell yeah, she know Nile. Lots of time he come round, she be rapping to him. He like her caseworker or some such. She kicking on them benches with him. Rap for hours seem like, she know him good.
Tommy glances my way just to be sure I've registered that. Nile was nice to Lavinia. She'd want to protect him. The remainder of the direct is somewhat anticlimactic. Cor explains the plan, how Lavinia called him when June showed up. When he gets to the point where June was shot, Cor winds his head around sorrowfully over the mistake. And when was the last time you spoke to Nile Edgar?
Morning all this coming down. He beeped when I was fixing to leave out. So I give him a shout off the payphone down there in T4, say all this cool.
Tommy takes hold of the computer records from Niall's phone and directs Cor's attention to the call to his pager at 6:03 a.m. Cor affirms this is the page which he answered from the payphone outside the IV tower. Then Tommy cleverly uses the various stipulated phone records to review the entire direct. Was this call on May 14th, around the time you agreed to meet Senator Edgar? Was this call on August 7, around the time you agreed to kill him? When he's done, it's near 4:30, and we adjourn. The transport deputies cuff Cor to walk him back. His lawyer, Jackson Ayers, who has watched the proceedings from a folding chair just inside the plexiglass partition, approaches Cor at the lockup door and rests a hand on his shoulder as they consult, nodding emphatically, telling Cor he's done well. Hobie has gathered up his boxes quickly and pushes Nile, who is still gesticulating toward Hardcore, out of the courtroom. Tommy and Rudy, and Montague, who's entered to help haul things downstairs, are lingering at the prosecution table, smiling among themselves. They've had their ups and downs, but the week has ended well. The reporters have disappeared, as if by magic, all racing to beat deadline with today's spicy item. A convicted gang leader testified today that the plot to murder Senator Loyal Edgar began when gang leaders angrily rebuffed Edgar's efforts to turn the Black Saints' disciples into a political organization. A weird story, but it has the eerie resonance of a tale too odd to be untrue. In the subdued clamor of the spectators' departure, I sit still on the bench, gripping my pen and staring at the pages of the bench book, which are covered with hurried notes I've made today. The critical line from Kratzis. My father was supposed to be going over there, is underscored at the top of the upper left-hand side. Considering it all, an omen bounds home in me. I'm going to find Nile Edgar guilty. Nikki loves costumes. She imagines herself with stylish dos and beaded gowns. I took to heart my mother's distaste for glamour and am always alarmed. Where does Nikki get these ideas, I wonder? Is this the penalty for working, for not being at her side 24 hours a day? When I pick her up from daycare tonight, she is wearing plastic high heels on the wrong feet and a crown.
I'm getting married, she squeals.
Married, my heart shrieks, but I take her in with kisses, knowing that this instant when we're reconnected for the weekend is, in ways, the point toward which I've been journeying all week. We have stew for dinner, just the way you like it.
No peas?
She asks. Not one. When Nikki was born, I decided I would become organized. I would cook meals in advance and freeze them, like my friend Grace Tomazic. I would keep extensive grocery lists so that I would no longer have to go to the store 3 times each day. I would start shopping from catalogs for clothes and buy a season ahead so I was not desperate when the weather changed. I would sign up for Moms and Tots on Saturdays. Finally, an adult, I would have a life reflecting forethought rather than waning moods and windblown caprice. I wanted this with desperate, almost unbearable longing, as the sign of some gathering of myself, as an affirmation of the capacity of any person to make her life a bit more bearable. And I succeeded, after a fashion. Oh, of course, I become preoccupied, with the cases before me, with one feud or another with Charlie, with the madness in Bosnia, or a memory of my mother that has not visited me in years. Anything that catches me on the spike of passion and ends up making me seem, especially to myself, unfocused, even scatterbrained. But for the most part, I have made my life less a momentary adventure. Nikki and I have a routine. There are meals in the freezer, which I, generally speaking, remember to defrost. The lunch bag is packed. Amid the whirl of single mom responsibilities, I often feel like one of those little old ladies, old world ethnics dressed all in black, wobbling around like a top about to fall. On occasion, I'm undermined by uncertainty about myself. A few months back, as I was listening to the discordant screech of Avi, Gwendolyn's son, sawing away at his Suzuki violin, I was jarred by panic. What was I going to do about music lessons? I'd never even thought of it. I called piano teachers all night. Lately, I felt pangs because Nikki knows nothing of religion. But it happens, all of it. My life has what planning always seemed to imply. A center, weight, substance, love. Love. I've been so lucky, I think all the time. Not in the ordinary outward sense that people have in mind with that phrase. Because after all, I've had my pratfalls and distractions, my own tough patches, sickness and divorce, the ordinary major miseries of an ordinary existence. But I'm so lucky to have Nikki, to have someone to love, unambiguously and durably, someone for whom my love will never falter. Love, whatever it means, has otherwise been an unreliable thing in my life. With my mother, with men. In my younger years, it made no sense to me that one word referred to sexual relations and your family. You have to get older for all of that to cohere, to understand it comes down to the same thing: intensity, connection, commitment, some mecca toward which your soul can always pray. After dinner, a bath. Nikki frolics, inventing games with Barbie dolls who, except for the moments of their evening drowning, dwell on the tub side in consummate nudity, despairing, no doubt, over the sad fate of their plastic hair, which Nikki's repeated stylings have left a mass of ratted knots.
"I like Jenna better than Marie," says Nikki. "But they're both black."
Once again, panic is forestalled. Teach, always teach.
"You know, Nikki, whether someone is nice has nothing to do with the color of their skin. You're nice from the inside, not the outside."
She pouts. She bugs her eyes.
"Mommy, I know that."
Some propositions are obvious, even to a 6-year-old. Eventually, I extract her from the tub. Already, I find myself longing for the baby who has only recently disappeared, the 3- and 4-year-old with her winsome malapropisms.
"It's dark outside. Come on."
For come on. Now she sometimes seems a being of unknown origins, with tastes and even physical attributes I've never encountered in myself or even Charlie. Where does she get these fingers, I wonder, as I'm toweling her dry, which look tallowy as melting party candles?
"Have I told you how wonderful you are?"
I ask, kneeling beside Nikki's bed.
"No,"
Nikki answers at once, as she does each evening.
"Well, you're wonderful.
You're the most wonderful person I know. Have I told you how much I love you?"
"No,"
she answers, squirming shamefaced against my chest. "I love you more than anything in the world." I cuddle her until she sleeps, an indulgence I should not permit, but it's a precious moment. Again, the simplest atom, nucleus, and particle. Asleep, Nikki is soft and smells sweetly of her shampoo. Afterwards, in the quiet house, I lounge in the living room. A glass of white wine is spun experimentally by the stem between my fingertips. At long last, I reach the glorious moment when I remove my pantyhose. Now, after the parade of the day is over, I find out what has stuck before it grows into something new in the hothouse of dreams. Night sounds rise up from the city, wind against the gutters, passing cars, teens a block away exuberant with their mischief. Above the painted brick fireplace, a Modigliani hangs, a narrow-faced girl in whose inscrutable pose I have always recognized something of myself. While Charlie lived here, I spent hours staring at that painting, since I was loath to move around while the poet was in the throes of creation. From Charlie's study in the extra bedroom, the strong blue smoke of his hand-rolled cigarettes would penetrate the room. He used tobacco brands you saw in westerns, Bugler and Flag, and could dip his thick fingers into the pouches and line a paper without ever looking up from the page. His concentration as he wrote was fabulous. He wouldn't have heard the bomb, but he demanded that the house be still, and so until he finished, and God knew when that would be, I would work out here with a cup of tea, cringing if the cup even rang on the saucer. Love's zombie, an unhappy refugee in my own home. And with this memory, as the fretting of the work week recedes, as the courtroom with its tentacles of repulsion and fear falls behind me, I am arrowed by the terrible, humbling poignance of the simplest truth. I'm busy, flyabout, overburdened. True enough. But I know this secret, too. In the marrow of the bone, where blood is made and beliefs are gathered, I'm hungry for the intimate company of other humans. I am lonely, and it is not merely a symptom of divorce. There were years, years married to Charlie, when I felt like this, wondering, as I still do, how long it will go on. And then, unpredictably, stealthy as a thief, the line that went by in passing days ago returns, haloed with all the urgent sincerity with which it was spoken. "How many people," Seth asked, "how many people do you get close to in a life?"
May 2nd, 1970. Seth. I did not sleep further after June's visit. It was 3:30 by then, and I lay awake, telling myself no, then yes, telling myself it was crazy and wrong, and then that it was right for just that reason. Near 5, when I was going to leave, I called Hobie's. Lucy's voice was slurred with sleep.
"He's not here," she whispered.
Hobie kept luxurious hours. He read all night and had not attended a morning class throughout college. I was sure that Lucy, pliant as ever, was under instructions to tell me he wasn't there, but when I challenged her, a tide of distress rose through her voice.
"He hasn't spent the night here all week," she cried,
then went quiet. She said I could leave a message at Cleveland's.
"If anyone picks up the phone," she added.
I tried to think. "How you hanging?" I asked eventually.
"Shitty."
That required no explanation. I told her I needed to see her, to say goodbye, if nothing else, and we agreed to meet on Polk Street, where Lucy had an appointment that afternoon. After work, I clawed through the Saturday traffic in an uneven mood. I had just made my farewells at After Dark. My days as a sci-fi columnist, the only line of work I'd ever felt any pride in, were now at an end. I'd hugged Harley Minks. He gave me a guidebook to Vancouver. Then I'd gone out the swinging back doors, with their rubber bumpers to protect against the damage done by the hand trucks, and left one more portion of my life behind me, knowing it was nothing I'd have chosen to do. Polk Street was the usual florid scene. Hell's Angels, drag queens in cheap dresses, and leather cowpokes all paraded on the avenue, while shoppers ran between the cafes and exotics stores. A white-haired woman in a tight sweater stood on a corner with a pure white cockatoo on her shoulder. At the sight of Lucy, I brought the car to a squealing halt. She stood on the corner, looking dazedly into the sun, searching for me, perhaps. Blood was streaming down her cheeks. I leaned out the window, waving and yelling, and finally drew to the curb. By the time I'd pushed her through the passenger door, horns were sounding in a rough chorus behind me in the traffic. In my side view, I saw a cop approaching and jerked the bug into the street, strangely frightened by the thought of an encounter with the police. Jesus, I said. Jesus, what's going down? What happened to you? I asked if she wanted to go to the hospital. She had popped her contacts into her open palms and sat with her head thrown back.
I do it all the time, she said. I forget I have my lenses in. I cry, and then I rub my eyes, and it cuts something. Just on the surface of the eyeball. I'll be all right.
Oh, God,
she said, and began to cry again. The tears, now a milder pink, streaked her face. I drove around and finally parked up on Russian Hill. She had seen an herbalist, someone she had heard about, a hippie with a tiny third-story shop. For what? She faltered.
My skin.
Lucy was freckled, but her complexion was otherwise unblemished. Your skin? What do you have, like a rash? She rolled her eyes at my dullness. One of her contacts was in her mouth for cleaning, and she had to spit it out before she could speak.
2 weeks ago, Hobie got rid of the dog. He took it out to Campus Bowl and tied it to a parking sign. He said he wasn't going to live with a big white animal.
She peered, waiting for me to understand.
I heard they have something you chew, you know? For maybe a month? It, like, works gradually. It makes your skin darker. It, like, dyes you. It's pigment or something. I don't know. Anyway, the guy didn't have it. He said he'd heard of it, but he didn't have it, and wasn't sure where I could get it. And I just came out of there. I had this feeling like, oh man, it's never going to work. I mean, my whole life is falling apart, Seth. What am I going to do?
My reaction, of course, was that it was crazy. She had tiny prom queen features. She'd looked like a brown white person, like someone who'd overdone it with man tan. But she was obviously beyond the point of practicality. That Lucy's love, her need for Hobie, was that large, touched me. It was such a dispiriting contrast to the way Sunny had responded to me. I asked again about Hobie. She had no idea where he'd gone. She thought he'd been with Cleveland, but she'd called the police station, and he hadn't been arrested. He had been appearing at home sporadically for weeks now, seemingly arriving only in order to tell her that he couldn't keep living with a white girl. The implication, which Lucy refused to acknowledge, was that he was coming back to find out if she'd left. What's he doing? Where do you think he is? I asked.
I don't know. He still goes to school, but after that?
What about this bomb at the ARC? Did he have anything to do with that? She turned quickly to the window. She said nothing at first.
You know about that stuff, right?
She asked.
That he bought?
Right. The battery acid and sandbags. I knew about that stuff.
I think he kind of figured out what it was for, eventually. I mean, nobody told him. He just sort of added things up. I don't know, Seth. He didn't say much.
But he didn't plant the bomb, did he? He didn't help plan.
Hobie? No. God, no. He couldn't have. Could he?
I reconsidered June's warning. Perhaps she merely meant that if the dominoes fell, Hobie would be in trouble. One arrest would lead to another. I had some powerful vision of Hobie, but it left me as bitter as I was concerned. In the interval, Lucy had started crying once more.
God, Seth,
she said again.
What am I going to do?
Lucy was raised in what used to be called a broken home. Her parents had divorced when she was three. Her father, a well-known lawyer, sent lots of money but appeared infrequently. Her mother was a sort of airy socialite, a martini in one hand, a cigarette in the other, and usually a man nearby to light it. Lucy had come of age in an atmosphere of unfaltering politeness, which as a child left her baffled about whether the air of restraint she always sensed was refinement or indifference. As a teen, she'd tried to find out. She had run away to a macrobiotic commune in Vermont when she was 16. Then, when she was supposed to have been back on track, she took up with Hobie. Lucy told her mother all about her boyfriend, except that he was black. News which my mother-in-law absorbed at once when she came home early one evening during a holiday break and found them fucking away in one of the living room wing chairs, Lucy's slender, freckled legs wrapped around Hobie's medium brown behind. In college, as a freshman, Lucy depended on Hobie helplessly. He picked her courses, approved her dresses, gave her books to read, and he relished her slavish attentions. Then, every 2 or 3 months, he would do her wrong. Some girl would take an interest, and Hobie would disappear to her dorm room, often for days. Lucy would hang out with me, go to coffee, and beat me at two-handed bridge with an ease I found baffling, since I had not yet recognized the brain power obscured behind her self-doubts. For the most part, however, she would simply pine incredibly until Hobie returned. There was even one occasion when she stood outside the dormitory where Hobie and the new girl had repaired and moaned for him, a gesture which Hobie was frank enough to admit he had found quite stimulating. Somehow, Lucy never seemed to give a thought to saying enough was enough. She groaned even now at the thought of losing him. "Look, my place will be empty in a few days. Why don't you move in there?"
"God," she said. "God, I don't want to be alone, Seth."
The one word "alone" emerged in a tone I sometimes heard in the singing in temple during the high holidays. An age-old lament, a permanent misery. I held her. "Then move in today. You'll have company until Monday. That's my induction date. I have to take off for the Great North then." The recollection of June, their plan, the kidnapping, recurred. A percussive feeling radiated through me as it had at many moments since the bombing of the ARC. I felt unmoored. The Edgars' power seemed dominating, because they alone pointed unhesitatingly in a known direction.
"Maybe I'll come too," Lucy said. "To Canada?"
"Sure," I said. There was nothing else to say, but she took note of my tone, dead of enthusiasm. She stared desolately out the window, trying not to cry. Suddenly, I took hold of Lucy and spoke to her largely as I had spoken to myself since the morning. "Look, you've got to leave it behind. We both do. All of it. Hobie, everything else. Everything is changing. Everything. It's like what we wanted, and now we're getting it. And it's happened. And whether it's good or bad, we have to go with it. We just have to go with it." I gripped her shoulders, much as June had gripped mine, and peered into Lucy's small, bright eyes, hoping to see there some sign, some spark, so that I would know I'd persuaded her and, therefore, myself. I called my father at work. He was there 6 days a week reliably. Although it was Saturday, he never departed before 5.
"Dad, you haven't gotten any goofy calls or anything, have you? From some guys out here?"
I heard him calculating, drumming. A symphony soughed faintly from a small console radio he kept behind his desk.
"Calls? You refer to what, sis?" "There are some guys here, nuts. I've seen them around the building. I don't know who they are or what they are. Somebody says they're witches."
"Witches?"
Back in Kendall County, my father was astounded by such a thing.
"I don't know, Satanists. They call themselves the Dark Revolution. You can't believe the goofballs out here, Dad. Jesus. One of these guys has got an afro that's literally dyed the colors of the spectrum. I'm not kidding. Red hair, blue hair, purple hair. For real."
My father grunted in disbelief.
"Anyway, a guy I know pretty well, he came to me yesterday, strictly on the QT, and he says these guys, the Dark Revolution guys, have been talking about holding me for ransom because I'm Bernard Weissman's son."
"Oh, for God's sake," said my father. "For God's sake. For God's sake. Have you explained?"
"Sure, I explained. Not that Weissman. No relation of any kind. I said it all. But I'm not sure this other guy believed me. I just wondered.
He said they'd had this plan for, like, a long time, you know? And they got nervous or something because they heard I'm about to leave? I thought maybe they were going to do something. I don't know.
Have you contacted the police?
The police? What'll they do?
The police will do what the police do. Investigate. Look into matters.
Pa, Jesus. If they investigated every person in Damon, California, who said weird things, they'd work from dawn to dusk and never finish going down campus bull. That's all I have to do to piss these guys off. The thing for me is to just collect my crap and get out of the country.
After a pause, my father said,
That is no solution.
June sat watching me near the phone. She was close enough to whisper. She held a notepad and a pen, but she had not added a word yet. Instead, she was faintly smiling. I was well past the dialogue we'd rehearsed, flying free, and feeling a distinct glee in secretly holding the upper hand on my father.
Look, let's not fight about this. I'll call you in a couple of days.
Sess, I want your word that we will have a further discussion before you take any ultimate steps. I expect such a promise.
Yeah, I promise. But something has to happen by Monday. Look, Pa, don't say anything to Mama, okay?
He snorted. Of course not. In her state, ransom demands, that is the last thing she needs to hear.
It would be straight to the asylum, he said.
That was great, said June as she took the phone.
What?
My father's last remark about the asylum was like a stab wound.
We've talked about this, June said. Your safety will never be in doubt. They'll know you're safe at every moment. It will simply be a question of your release.
The insanity of this, the debased, frantic nature of everything, inside me and elsewhere, swam over me. Edgar came down to my apartment in a few minutes. It was just as everyone said. He was never present when anything of consequence occurred. June related all the plans. Edgar sat beside her, brittle as glass, the muscles popping up along his jaw. Occasionally, when something required discussion, the two of them left the room.
Everything's all right, June said.
He nodded remotely, so that even now you could not say for certain he knew what she was talking about. Out on the landing, there were footsteps, a heavy thump, before a piffling knock on the door. Edgar had wheeled with alarm, but when he threw the door back, Lucy was there, whipping her hair out of her eyes and sniffling. She wore her backpack, a huge green duffel, stuffed oozingly, slumped over the threshold. Her pillow was beneath her arm. She considered the three of us, seeming to hold her ground.
I'm coming to Canada, she told me.
We have your son, the note read. As in the movies, the message was a collage of letters clipped out of the newspaper and pasted on the page. The words had been surprisingly easy to find. A Sears ad in the Chronicle proclaimed, We have your size, sale on Friday. June had stood over the opened pages. She said,
Fate.
It was Saturday night. Lucy was downstairs with Niall. Edgar, of course, was nowhere to be seen. Assembling the package, June wore yellow rubber gloves. She and Edgar were deadly earnest about precautions, even though I continued to explain that my parents would never contact the authorities.
Control the random element, she said.
When June finished, she headed off for Railway Express. Sent by air, the package, a small white gift box, would be delivered to my father's office on Monday before noon. Within, he'd find the note and the mezuzah I had received from our congregation at my bar mitzvah. It was a tiny silver cylinder, emblazoned with a Star of David, containing a parchment scroll on which were written the words Deuteronomy required all Jews to speak each day. I wore it mindlessly, regarding it as an implement of fashion, a Jewish equalizer, so that in gym I would have neckwear like the Gentile guys who wore St. Christopher's medals and crosses. Yet it didn't seem strange that my parents would recognize this as emblematic of me. That thought, unexpected, was the only tweaking of genuine feelings I experienced. I handed the mezuzah to June with the disembodied emotions that had accompanied much of what I'd done lately. Once again, I was undergoing something momentous, but time just passed. Things just happened. Traumhaft. When the word came to mind, I suddenly beamed. June looked at me oddly, but did not wait to ask if I was having second thoughts.
So, he comes back yesterday,
Lucy explained to Michael at dinner on Sunday night.
And he just starts packing. I mean, Jesus. Where's my dashiki? Where's my pick? He's running all over. That's all he's saying. And I'm like, Hobie, what's going on here? Talk to me, honey. And it's like, I'm not even there. I'm following him around.
She couldn't bear more. She started crying. It was nothing to notice by now. She had been crying constantly for 24 hours.
He said, you better get out of here too. The shit's coming down now, and it ain't too funky.
What did that mean? I'd heard the story too many times, but in each telling there was something new. Cops? She had no idea.
He was in this, like, for real sweat. He kept running to the window, and I'm trying to ask him about, you know, us. Honestly. He looked at me like I was flipped out completely, like, who could bother? And I'm like, Jesus, Hobie, where am I supposed to go? What am I supposed to do? And it's...
Weeping, she couldn't find words to relay his indifference. Where is he? Michael asked. Does he know where you are? She flapped both arms uselessly. Michael, for his part, was somewhat better. He still looked desolate and bleary, but he appeared more contained.
I don't know, sort of. I told him, I think I'll help Seth get up to Canada.
She looked at me.
Do you think he'll call?
No, I said. I don't. I was well past the point of humoring her. It would be some drive north, honking geese and a blubbering hippie. Not that I wouldn't have welcomed the chance to see Hobie before I left tomorrow, except for the grimy, twisted bit between the Edgars and my father, the direst secret, they warned, which I would have been far too ashamed to share anyway. My plans remained more or less as they'd been. The Edgars would collect the ransom. I would leave. Michael and Lucy and I were drinking wine, supposedly celebrating my last night before becoming a fugitive of the state. We'd lit a candle, stuck in a Chianti bottle, and picked at a crab and a big sourdough bread that Lucy had bought the day before, preparing for a sentimental reunion with Hobie. Our conversation never got much beyond Lucy's tortured recollection of how those plans went awry. Somehow, the subject offered heartsore reminders to each of us of the failures of romance. What a trio we are, I said suddenly. There was a bedtime story I'd read a dozen times to Niall. One animal's blind, one's deaf, another can't speak. They find each other and thrive. They form a band. But I always closed the book thinking, what a wretched, depleted community. I couldn't help myself. I laughed out loud. Love's wasted remains. Michael received my remark with his worn, silent smile and cleaned his plate. By the time the late news came on, Lucy was asleep on the sofa. I tried once or twice to revive her, to share my amazement over what was taking place. On Saturday, at the New Haven rally in support of Bobby Seale, demonstration leaders had called for a national student strike to protest the war. Nixon had denounced the campus radicals as bums, but the idea of a strike was spreading. 11 college newspapers across the country, including the ones at Princeton, Sarah Lawrence, and Damon, had endorsed the plan. In Cambodia, on the other hand, the invading U.S. troops were finding few signs of a North Vietnamese presence. As a base of operations, as they called it, June had selected the campus travel motel, located down on the east side of Damon, where Campus Bull met the highway. From there, our business would be done and my departure made. I was supposed to meet June there around noon on Monday. That morning, I went upstairs to see Niall off for school. "Shake," I said. He grabbed my thumb, handover style, an obedient trainee in the Rev. June had begged me not to say goodbye to him. She couldn't endure a scene. I explained only that I was taking a trip and wouldn't be around after school. "I'm going to send you lots of postcards."
"I like candy,"
Niall said, somewhat solemnly, as if I didn't know. I pitched my bags into the bug and drove down to Robson's. I had seen Sonny's little white waitress outfit in the closet, the stiff apron and white shoes inspiring a few half-humorous overtures about playing nurse. But it was disconcerting to see her dressed that way. It made it seem as if years had passed instead of a few weeks. Her hair was bundled back into a net, and a little white cap, a crepe tiara, sat atop her like some nesting bird. She lit up when she saw me push through the door, so that unruly emotions suddenly overcame me as I drew up to her at the old lunch counter. "D-Day." I shoved my hands into the pockets of my jeans for lack of anything else to do.
"I know."
She'd been counting, of course.
"I was afraid you'd gone already. I wish you'd let me call. Gus, I'm going outside."
Behind the lunch counter, Gus wiped a hand on his greasy apron and nodded without other comment. He was sucking the last from a cigarette. She grabbed her jacket off a peg in the back and walked me out the rear through the commotion of the kitchen. The floor was red concrete and grimy.
"Right back,"
she yelled in response to someone's protest, and clanked through the back grate into the alley. The refuse of the restaurant, melon husks and thick freezer bags from French fries, was piled beside the dumpster, rotting fragrantly in the sun. Down one doorway, a cat sprawled on its back on a wooden step, waving its paw in the sunshine in a moment of feline languor, invulnerable and relaxed, seeming to enjoy some memory buried in the DNA of its foregone glory as a tiger. Once we were alone, Sonny came up and hugged me, held on just to be close, as if there weren't any time or differences between us. The feel of her body, so familiar, crushed me in a vice of difficult emotion.
"You waited till the last minute,"
she said. "Yeah, I've been jailbait for about an hour. There's some recruiting officer looking at my name on a list, checking the traffic reports for the highway, and hoping like hell he doesn't have to fill out all the goddamn paperwork." Amid all the uncertainties of the moment, this decision still felt inalterably correct. We talked about the Peace Corps. Her designation had come through with unexpected speed. She'd be leaving for Manila within the next month. Her assignment was at a family planning center in the north part of the country. She spoke without notable enthusiasm. It was already a particular place. A job. Signing up, she'd envisioned the bush, the jungle, contact with timeless, indigenous cultures. But the descriptions of the center brought to mind those teeming Asian cities, Bombay, Bangkok. Desperation, debasement, filth, an entire population longing for the corruption of the rich. For the time being, she seemed less certain that in journeying 10,000 miles, she was going to find adventure or truth, whatever it was she thought she'd miss hanging out with me.
"It'll be great," I said. "I hope so. Graham is quoting Horace. They change their clime, but not their minds, who rush across the sea."
She shrugged, somewhat melancholic. She had on white tights and clunky white earth shoes. Her coat, probably Graham's, a black jeans jacket, covered her hands.
"Guess what?" I said.
"Groovy's hitting the road with me."
"Really?"
"She and Hobie are Splitsville. You know, she's being a pal. Moral support, that kind of thing."
"Right, moral support," said Sonny. "She's been wanting to get next to you forever."
"Bullshit.
Hey, women can tell this stuff."
It was making her happy, I knew, this kind of flirting,
pretending I already had a happy, separate life. I'm just a ride, Sonny.
What about your parents?
I think I've worked it out, I said stoically. She had lived with me too long, however, not to register the change of tempo. I was helpless as she measured me with one of her dark, searching looks. She understood more about me, I realized, than I'd ever really figured out about her.
Are you up to something, baby?
Something, I answered. It was calling me baby that did it. I had planned to be remote, to guard absolutely the secret, as the Edgars had insisted. With Lucy, for example, I had said we were leaving from the motel in case the army recruiters came looking for me, a silly fiction, since by every account there would be no hunt for me for weeks until my name was reported to the FBI. Cross your heart? I asked. She stood back, wary already. I'm being kidnapped. I smirked, in spite of the sick breach that opened in me at the mere thought of the next step.
Kidnapped?
She zeroed in quickly.
What does that mean? What are you telling them?
Don't ask, I said. You wouldn't believe it. She grabbed my sleeve.
Is Hobie involved with this?
Forget it. It's cool, really. It's a bit of a mad stunt, but it's safe for everyone. Just keep it to yourself, okay? Now that she had hold of me, she did not let go. She came close again.
Seth, don't go crazy on me.
It's the times, I said. It's in the air. I didn't say a word of blame about her, but we both knew.
God,
she said.
Why do I feel so terrible? Have I been really lousy to you?
The end could have been better, but it's like the stories I make up. It's usually the case.
I like your stories,
she said, nestled against me. Here we were again, like that cry lost in the fog. I want to be with you. I can't. I had no understanding of what tethered her inside herself, only that she was straining against it, and that, however faintly, I was not completely without hope. 25 years from now, you may feel real bad about this.
I feel real bad now.
She took a deep breath.
Call me as soon as you're safe. You promise?
For sure.
I want to know just where you are.
In case you change your mind? She smiled faintly. It's not too late, I said.
I know.
It was the closest she had been yet. I'll be waiting. I walked on that observation. I had my movie dream that I'd hear her racing up from behind, but she didn't. Not yet. I turned to check, to wave. The best I got was that she lingered amid the garbage cans in a patch of sun and tapped the spot over her heart. At 10 a.m. precisely, we placed the call to my father's office. The terror that raveled his voice was extraordinary. I realized again how close it lurked beneath the surface of his life.
Oh, my God, Seth!
Dad, I'm all right. Really, I'm all right.
Where are you?
I can't tell you. They're right here. It's been a little wild.
Okay, that's enough,
June said beside me, loud enough to be heard. The motel room was dismal, clean, but otherwise on its last legs. It must originally have been war construction, a barracks perhaps. The walls were clad at half height in plastic sandalwood-colored paneling, presumably to hide the gouges. June had drawn the heavy green drapes. They understand that they have the wrong guy, I told my father. I mean, they do now. I finally got them to take me over to the library this morning. I showed them Bernard Weissman in Who's Who, and your biography in American Economists. It took a while to find something that had your son's name.
They have let you go?
Not exactly.
Okay, said June. So he's alive. He's breathing. He's fine.
She grabbed the phone. Her voice was hoarsened in a way that nearly made me laugh. After all her talk of drama school, I'd expected an inspired performance, something method, wholly unique. Instead,
She seems simply to have borrowed the manner of the gritty radio dramas, The Shadow or Johnny Dollar, which were still on the air when I was a boy. But she'd correctly calculated the effect. This was, after all, real life, where the overdone suggested someone sinisterly bent beyond normal restraint. My father was terrified.
"Who is this?"
he cried. I was poised not far from the earpiece.
"This is me. This is the Dark Revolution. This is the voice of truth, okay? Next time I call, I'm going to tell you what you can do to make us let him go. First thing, you have to listen to the rules and obey the rules. Rule one, no phone calls over 1 minute. And your minute is up right now. Bye-bye."
After she clapped down the phone, my father must have sat in his office for some time, perhaps checking his own pulse until he could reestablish his normally orderly thoughts. Perhaps he stared at his coarse, pallid face reflected on the glass of one of his diplomas or citations. Certainly, as always, he talked to himself. The world, he thought, had ceased being a reasoning place. People roamed like beasts, seized by unpredictable emotion, giving vent to wretched fantasy. Waking or sleeping, daylight was the only membrane that separated him now from the turbulence of dreams. But a fragment of him must have been contented and serene. He had spent so many years preparing himself. He had always known he would see it all again. June called back in 15 minutes to tell him they wanted ransom.
"You have money. You can pay."
"I am a university professor. I am a poor man."
I heard that cunning tone I'd listened to at store counters 1,000 times as he criticized quality, the price, hoping for some edge with which to bargain. With a bitter smile, I had predicted exactly what he would do, and even so, something in me crumbled. There was no hope.
"What am I to pay? How? You understand, I am not that Weissman."
He went on that way another instant before she interrupted.
"You want to know where your son is now? You have any neighbors with a dog? That's where your son is. He has a dog's choke collar around his throat. It's attached to the fucking wall. His hands are manacled. So are his feet. He sits when we say. He stands when we say. He gets to pee every 4 hours. Maybe we'll let him go next year. Maybe the year after. I don't care. Dog food's cheap. Do you understand me? Now it's your choice. If that's what you want, you just have to say it. That's rule number two. You tell me what you want. Do you want that? You want us to treat your son like some mangy, flea-ridden, shedding, dog-shit-shitting dog? We'll do that. You just say. Is that what you'd like? I want to hear you say that. Come on. Follow the rules."
I had never heard my father cry before. He emitted a stifled wheeze, then his voice shattered. I bent over completely and covered my head.
"I want $20,000, that's all. Just 20. We went into this figuring $2 million. It's fucked up, okay, but we have expenses. This whole fucked up operation wasn't cheap. We have mouths to feed. We have a lot of people who are a lot of disappointed, okay? And we need time to make some nice new plans. Now either you help us with that, or we won't be helping you, okay? That's a rule too, dig?"
He was crying too hard to answer.
"No police, FBI, kitty cops, Pinkertons, no one, okay? We set the conditions,"
said June. She nodded as she held the receiver in the wan light of the cheap lamp. I had sunk to one of the beds and could no longer hear him.
"You pay this sum and he's free, subject to conditions. We don't get caught. This never happened. That's how it goes. I don't trust you. You don't trust me. So we set the conditions."
"What conditions?" he must have asked.
Next call.
June smacked down the phone. She closed her eyes to grab hold of herself, to find her real life, before she looked down at me.
It's going fine, she said.
December 9th, 1995. Sunny. The home in which Nikki and I live is a narrow, rehabbed graystone in University Park. The contractor carved a garage out of the cellar and laid a downsloping drive that floods in the winter thaw. Beneath the limestone ledges of the tall, double-hung windows of the upper floors, wrought iron flower boxes hold fall geraniums, now withered in their terracotta pots. Charlie and I paid too much for this place, and I will never get what I need if we sell, a step I often contemplate. The suburbs on the East Bank, with their stable, well-funded public schools and quiet, tree-lined streets, seem tempting. At least a quarter of the families of the children who started in Nikki's nursery school program are gone to that safer world. But whenever I contemplate the move, I hear Zora, "The suburbs," she used to exclaim. "Better a lobotomy." This morning, Saturday, is crowded. Nikki demands a pancake breakfast and then time with her cartoons. I have to get the car into the shop. It's leaking oil again, a shimmering gunmetal puddle on the garage floor. Walking home from Boyce's repair, both of us are grumpy. I fret about how to handle the working woman's travail of Saturday grocery shopping without a car, while Nikki fears we'll miss Sam, Charlie's son by his first marriage, who is coming by to take his little sister to the Dries Center for a production of The Princess and the Pea. I often say that I had more anxiety about parting from Sam than Charlie. From infancy, Sam was with us every weekend. He is a special kid, even more so to me, because he proved to be the one human being on Earth who finally reassured me I would check out okay as a mother. Sam's own mom, Rebecca, is high-strung and still scorns me a decade later as a homewrecker. Once Charlie left, I was positive she'd never allow Sam back into my home. But Sam tolerated no change. He calls Nikki at least once each week and bikes over from his mother's house, a few blocks away, most Saturday afternoons. He lets himself in, sits while I run errands. He makes them snacks. They play at the computer. I find them, both agape before the screen, Nikki seated on one of his knees. It's all a mystery. How could a crabbed soul like Rebecca have raised a boy like this? He is funny and brilliant with the heart of a hero. He plays the piano with passion. He acts and plays. At 12, he is full of feeling and, not so incidentally, pain. After all, he is Rebecca's son, she of the shrewish moods and damaging tongue. Worse, he's been deserted by Charlie. He seems to cling to Nikki because they are joined not merely by blood, but by circumstance. Not just the gene load Charlie left behind, but the longing. Sam, I often think, has decided to heal himself by being a better man to Nikki than his father has been to both of them. Today he arrives in a winter parka he can no longer comfortably close. Charlie, a former wrestler, is huge, not so much tall as broad, and Sam is already headed for size. He's an athletic boy, far less awkward than many his age, although he has that stretched-out look of early adolescence. He is dark and very handsome and innocently pleased by his fine looks. He has begun to carry a comb to look for himself in any mirror we pass. I open the door to see them off and amazingly encounter Seth Weissman across the threshold, just lifting his hand to the bell. Like me, he's dressed in jeans and wears a fur-collared leather bombardier's jacket and a broad-brimmed Australian hat. He seems to be one of those bald-headed men with a lot of snappy headgear. A mistake, if you ask me, since it's just more shocking when they remove the cap. Nikki, this is a friend of mine, Mr. Weissman, and this is Nikki's brother, Sam. I loosen the furry hood so Seth can appreciate her in full glory. Seth praises her beauty and is careful also to give a moment to Sam. Word-struck, the two of us watch the children go. Wrapped in conversation, they pass the row of rehabbed townhomes, many handsomely trimmed out with Christmas lights. Nikki, as usual, picks up a stick and drags it musically along the line of wrought iron fences. They say you just teach them to leave you, I finally remark, from the first step. But you never leave them, he replies. His eyes shoot downward and I spend a moment damming my tongue, then step inside to grab my load and coat. Although I invite him into the entry, he will not cross the threshold. I've accomplished my mission, he says. She's gorgeous. Besides, I have to go to my father's, deal with the crisis of the day. His car was stolen. All these years I ragged him for driving around in a 1973 Caprice, and now, apparently, the damn thing's a vintage item. I confess I wouldn't mind if somebody stole my minivan and left me with the insurance money to buy a car that didn't require a standing appointment at the mechanics. Do you need a ride anywhere? He asks. I'm just going to the Green Earth. As a stopgap, I'll buy what I can carry. One night this week, I'll find a sitter so I can do the mammoth shopping trip even a family of two requires. These days, I'm always amazed how many people are in the store at 11 p.m. Up fourth? Isn't that on the way to my father's? Come on. He's politely insistent, and I don't know whether to say no. In his car, a rented Camry, Seth talks nervously, filling airtime, as if I might not notice that my resolve keeps breaking down. He points out sites around U Park, Phillips Playground, where he learned to play basketball and tennis, St. Bernard's, Hobie's grade school, an uninspired gray stone hulk occupying a quarter of a block. The parking lot at the store is thronged. There is a line 7 or 8 cars long waiting to enter, and a melee of shoppers weaving their stainless steel carts across the asphalt. We are stuck on U Ave, as first one, then half a dozen horns bray behind us. Seth